Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books in Anthropology, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in cultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. I am overjoyed today to welcome Professor Hilde Jorenz to the show. Professor Jorenz is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Marine Affairs at the University of Rhode Island, and the author of Imaging the Great Puerto Rican Family, Framing Nation, Race, and Gender During the American Century. Today, we are discussing her new book called Making Livable Worlds, Afro-Puerto Rican Women Building Environmental Justice, which was published in 2021 by the University of Washington Press. Professor Jorenz, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Could you talk about what inspired this book?
So this book is inspired, I think, in several ways, right? There isn't one source of inspiration, but it comes from multiple places. And I think one source of inspiration was, you know, my mother's family, the matriarchs of my family, my mother, my aunt, and several of my cousins. So I kind of wanted to in some way to honor their life experience. You know, my grandmother, my great grandmother, these are Afro-Puerto Rican women who, as I talk about in the book, were, you know, completely invisible to, I think, to the state and also, of course, to history. I think this book has always been with me in some way, right? This kind of concern about their lives and historicizing them and making sure that they and people like them, you know, are also seen, that their lives are seen as worthy, as, you know, important lives that contribute to the building of, you know, of society, you know, in Puerto Rico. But of course, people like them contribute to the building of societies, you know, all over the world, right? And so I was always concerned about women who are left out of history and who are invisible to history. And so that's one source of inspiration, you know, visibilizing women's lives, particularly women who are you just not seeing, you know, by academics and the state and policymakers and so on and so forth. And then on the other hand, or in tangent, you know, in relation to this source of inspiration, I was also inspired by the women activists that I met when I started the fieldwork for this project on environmental justice, right? And, you know, I met women who were a lot like, you know, the woman in my family, right? Who were matriarchs, who were supporting families, who were raising children, but who were also supporting communities and building life ways for their communities. And so when I met those women, I really, really wanted to also visibilize them. And I saw, you know, this is an anecdote. I always tell anecdotes. I think sometimes they're, you know, more telling than academic explanations, right? And as an anthropologist, of course, anecdotes, I think, are part of my just my fieldwork, you know, the way I hear the world and the way I retell the world. And so, you know, I would go to like community meetings where people are meeting around, you know, an issue, right? Like an initiative, or, you know, they're planning a protest, right? Or they're planning to, you know, submit paperwork to litigate against, you know, a polluting company, let's say, right? So I go to one of these meetings, and often I would see and hear the woman, right, doing, you know, a lot of the work to make things happen. So, you know, taking notes, or, you know, making or bringing the food, you know, to give out at the meeting, or making coffee and passing out the coffee, but taking notes and giving suggestions, right? And, you know, taking care of the kids in the background as they milled around. And I saw them being so central, not only to the, you know, planning, right, of the meeting, and but also of making it happen, and also of coming up with conceptual ideas and solutions. So they were, you know, involved in all of these aspects of these, you know, of this community organizing. And yet, whenever the press would come by, or, you know, whenever the protest would take place, it would be the guys, the men, who would talk as if they were the only ones at the forefront. Over and over and over. And then the woman would just stand there next to them, you know, quiet, as the camera was pointed at these men who were contributors to these initiatives, no doubt, but they weren't the protagonist. And so, you know, I saw this over and over and over, where the men's voice would be documented at the expense of the woman, who often had done so much more to actually make, you know, these initiatives come to fruition. And so that was really upsetting to me, because of course that's something that I have myself lived in academic spaces too, right? In lots of spaces where, you know, people will turn to the man next to me before they turn to me, if they turn to me at all. So I was very aware of this kind of invisibilization that women suffer, and particularly women of color, right? And Black women. And so I think, so that's another source of inspiration, where I really, really wanted to put the woman front and center as protagonists of, you know, the environmental justice movement and the initiatives, right, of these movements. So a lot of the thing that makes it, a lot of the initiatives that make it into the news, right, into the kind of mainstream, or, you know, into the media bubble, are things that are planned by women in their communities. So they're, you know, with very little resources as well, right, except their voice, you know, and their community behind them. So I really wanted to put them front and center. And then lastly, I wanted to mention that I was also really inspired by an essay that Arundhati Roy, you know, this wonderful Indian writer, she penned this essay. Well, it was, I don't know when she penned it, but it was published in 1999, right? And I really loved it. And I was like, you know, that is kind of a north for me, as I was thinking about this book, as this book was kind of in the back of my mind, you know, this essay came back to me again and again and again as a source of inspiration. And it's called The Greater Common Good, and it's on page 87 of my book. And I'll just read a small piece, but she said, "We have to support our small heroes." And in parentheses, she says, "Of these, we have many, many. Who knows? Perhaps that's what the 21st century has in store for us, the dismantling of the big dams, big ideologies, big contradictions, big countries, big wars, big heroes, big mistakes. Perhaps it will be the century of the small." And so for me, that was just that call of action, you know? And I said, you know, this book that's circling in my mind, you know, about putting women, invisible women, quote unquote front and center, is actually the path forward in this new century. That's it. No more of this letting history and letting these big ideologies and these big men stand in our light. So this is the kind of confluence of inspirations that allowed me to write this book.
And what audience did you have in mind for this book?
So for the audience, I mean, it's a short book, right? So I was hoping that it would be taught to students, you know, and I think it can be taught as early as high school, really, right? So, you know, along the lines of, I don't know, Howard Zinn's book, The People's History of the United States, right? You know, or Zora Neale Hurston's, right? Their Eyes Were Watching God. These books get taught in like in junior year of high school. So it could be taught as early as high school, but certainly in college, you know, and beyond. And anybody, I think the audience is anybody who's interested, right, in kind of understanding, you know, or in kind of being, anyone who's interested in being a part of the writing, correcting of history, I think might want to pick up this book, right? It's also, you know, Caribbean studies, Puerto Rican studies, Black studies, feminism and ecofeminism. So anyone with those kinds of interests, I think, would be should be able to read this book and gain something out of it. And of course, anthropology, it offers a critique of our discipline as well.
And you draw from very different sources and utilize a whole bunch of different methodologies. Could you maybe introduce a couple of these for listeners?
Yeah, so in terms of methodology, I think I often discuss methodology with one of my colleagues and close collaborators. And I should mention, I'll mention some names, some people that I work with, but Dr. Carlos Garcia Quijano, who I'll mention again, we've worked, you know, very closely together for many years. And I'll talk about him perhaps a little later, but in terms of methodology, he's an anthropological methodologist. And we often talk about how methodology responds to your question, right? So what the question you are asking, or the kinds of, right, the kinds of ways in which the kinds of data or information, right? I also have a critique of this idea of data, but the kinds of knowledge or information that you're seeking, you know, there are different kinds of methods for different kinds of information, I guess, in a plainer way, right? So methods is a tool, right, for discovery in some way, right? It's a tool for excavation. And if you have the right kinds of methods, right, you can produce the right, for your question, you can produce the right kind of knowledge, right, as a result of using these methods. And so in terms of methodology, right, I was using decolonizing ethnography, autobiographical example or autoethnography. And of course I use, you know, historical data or historical information, memory or memoir, and silence, right? I mean, I don't know if that counts as a method, but certainly I was also letting silence be, right? And letting that which is not known, unknown. So for this kind of project, and also it's a narrative, you know, I was also thinking about it in terms of, I should confess that I am a writer, and I call myself an anthropological writer, you know, and so I'm often thinking about narrating in my subconscious as I'm doing my work, my field work. I'm often thinking about narrating that which I am excavating. And so narrative always plays a part somewhere in my brain as I do this kind of ethnographic work. And this book also, you know, I talk about narrative reparation. So to repair that kind of gap or hole in the narrative of women's lives, right, is to also offer this kind of book that uses all these kinds of methodologies to produce or to unveil, I guess, a certain kind of knowledge, right? Rather than to produce, to unveil it, to bring it forth. And these different ethnographic methods or these different methodologies are each responding to something in my question, right? And my question is, you know, my question or one of them was, you know, where are women's lives in this social and environmental justice arena, right, in Puerto Rico, right? That's one of my questions. And so I had to use different kinds of methodologies to answer that or to think through that or to unveil through that. So with the colonizing ethnography, you know, it's a increasingly important, I think, suite of methods in anthropology and in the social sciences. And, you know, it does this thing in which it is at once, right, the ethnography, right, as descriptive, it's applied, right? So there's this descriptive applied component, but it also allows for the ethnography, the stories, right, the lives and knowledge of people who are marginalized to be theorized and actually for them to theorize their own lives too, right? So it has this activist component, you know, the colonized ethnography has an activist component as well. For me, it also grounds, the, you know, for me, the colonizing ethnography also grounds knowledge in, you know, the land, you know, in the ecosystem, in the ecosphere, in the knowledge of indigenous people who bubble, you know, who circling around in the atmosphere, in the case of Puerto Rico specifically, it's atmospheric because, right, indigenous people are no longer there in the land because they were within the first 50 years of Spanish settlement in Puerto Rico, indigenous people are said to have, quote unquote, disappeared, right? So, and what we don't talk about is the genocide and ethnocide of the Taino people, right? And so I really, for me, the colonized ethnography was also about really grappling with those people who were there when the Spanish settlers arrived and who were there in, to some degree when my ancestors, you know, were brought against their will from Africa. And so kind of really grappling with these kinds of layers that are still, you know, inscribed in the ecosystem, in, you know, in the land itself, in the language, in the food that we eat, you know? So I really wanted to grapple with those things. And so the colonized ethnography was, you know, the useful method, at least for me. And also to face, you know, it was also a way to come face to face in the mirror with myself. and kind of, so it turns out that for me, the colonized ethnography is also has this kind of like truth telling or honesty, you know, this kind of way in which I can't hide behind theory and methods and, you know, all of, you know, I couldn't hide, you know, myself here from this narrative. I couldn't fade away. You know, I was also there, right? And I was also there constructing a kind of narrative, right? And so, and you know, the autobiographical example, which is also, some people refer to it as autotheory and autoethnography. And I found that, I have found that useful in my entire body of academic writing. In fact, my very first publication, when I finished my dissertation, and my dissertation was autoethnographic, and then my very first publication was an autoethnographic article. And I found that because my family and, you know, my life history has represented, a slice of Puerto Rican history, I find it useful, right, to begin with what I know, right, with this kind of family history, and also to try to understand what I don't know. You know, it's also placing it within a more global context, right, and feeling less alone, right? We weren't the only family, right, who was, you know, whose ancestors were abducted, brought from Africa, made to toil in the plantations, who were then, you know, left to fend for themselves when the institution of slavery was abolished, but not, you know, which is fine, right? It shouldn't have been even an institution. But what happens is, you know, people fend for themselves in a really savagely capitalist and racist system. And so the options for a family like mine are very limited, you know? And so understanding also that this was a broader experience has also been really freeing and liberating. And so placing myself again in this family history at the center of 20th century history in Puerto Rico has been really important. And a way to relate with with the people with whom I worked, because it turns out I worked in the region where my family's from. And so, right, so it's kind of also understanding, so what happened to other families? How did they deal with it? And how did they then deal with the, you know, the environmental degradation that they were then facing after many of us exited, or, you know, as I say in the book many times, were ejected to the diaspora. So a bunch, you know, so many of us, thousands of us, left to the U.S. diaspora, right, to U.S. cities, in particularly at that time in New England, in places like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Chicago. But what happened to those people who stayed? How did they then confront, you know, the kind of savagery, I would say again, of this racial capitalism that continues to develop there, even, right? Or actually, I don't know, maybe more rapidly because so many people had left, right? So it became, you know, in some sense, and increasingly, I think, especially after the hurricane, it became understood as this depopulated region, right? And so the methods I was using was kind of answering these different queries about place, about people, about history, about ethnography, right? So a lot of themes that I think needed to be visibilized in relation to the lives of women who are absent from history and ethnography.
And you develop this concept of matriarchal dispossession. So what is matriarchal dispossession and what role does it play in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, so I talk about matriarchal dispossession, and I was thinking about it in relation to the history, as I said, of the woman, the matriarchal, you know, woman, the leaders, I would say, in some ways, in my own family, right? They're these matriarchs who were very strong. My mother, for one, and then my aunt and my cousins, they're all matriarchs in their family, in their familial units, but also they all act as matriarchs within the family structure. My family, I mean, this isn't just about my family. It's actually something that I saw again in the communities in the Jobos Bay where I was doing this environmental justice research. I saw very similar structures of, you know, the eldest as the, you know, the main matriarch with the woman in middle age, right, beginning to take leadership roles to actually make things happen. So the elder as matriarch would become a kind of advisor, right, that who people would consult as needed in relation to big life questions, right? And then the middle age matriarchs, that those people who were then coming into, you know, middle age, would be the people conceptualizing initiatives and doing and carrying things out, right? Because they were at that stage of life in which they could really be physical as well as mentally able to conceptualize like big things, big initiatives, big ideas. And then the younger people serving as helpers, right? But in serving as helpers, you're learning how to conduct yourself, right? And you're learning about what you can ask, or you know, what you can ask, or what you can do and what you cannot do yet, right? So it's kind of one of my nieces actually said something which I thought was interesting. She said, you know, our families are very hierarchical. And like, there is a way in, you know, there's a hierarchy, which I thought it was like a really good insight. There's a hierarchy and a way of doing things in relation to the matriarch, right? But that isn't a negative thing. That's also, right, respect for your elders, right? Which is actually an important tradition in the Southeast where I'm from, which is, of course, quite, you know, a region that is majority Afro-descendant. So this isn't something that was created, you know, hierarchy within a capitalist system. This is something that was passed down, you know, through intergenerational practice, right? In a region that is mostly Black and Afro-descendant and indigenous too, right? So there's this respect and this honoring of your elders, which is embedded in the way in which people practice their everyday lives, right? Which includes, of course, hierarchy, but not in that kind of rigid, you know, capitalistic way, right? Where there's a chain of command. That's not it. It's a hierarchy that respects and honors the knowledge, particularly, and experiences of your elders, right? And this is, you know, for women, this is a place in which they get to share knowledge. Right. After, you know, and right. For some women, this is, you know, as they age, they finally, you know, get respect, not only from their families, but from society. Right. So that's, you know, it's an interesting thing. So matriarchal dispossession, which is what you asked about originally, is this way in which impoverished single women are often blamed for their condition, right? And in the book, I talk about a quintessential, for at least for me, example of matriarchal dispossession was the backlash of the documentary After Maria, right? And I talk about it in their book, and it's a documentary that played on Netflix, I believe. And this documentary gathers, you know, produce so much ire in certain segments of the Puerto Rican society. And of course, I've seen that ire all my life because I grew up in an Afro-descendant, impoverished, single-headed household. And so I thought, wow, this is how we were shamed. Like, you know, it's so similar to how there was this feeling of shame about being poor, about, you know, being a single-headed household, about being Afro-descendant, and how we, you know, often felt these, you know, glares and people looking down upon us, you know, in among certain segments, right, the middle class, the educated, looked down upon impoverished single mothers, and this is historical, right? This isn't new. This is something that has been percolating in the society for a very long time. And so, and seeing, you know, single impoverished, particularly Afro-descendant mothers, as problematic, as a social problem, right? And matriarchal dispossession speaks about all of that, right? This kind of blaming the victim mentality that happens. But what all of that, you know, what all of this judgmental ire in the case of After Maria and in the case of, you know, the greater social whole, what all of this points to is really this ignorance about, you know, systemic gender oppression, right? About systemic racism, right? About racialization, about racial capitalism, right? So is what it does, what this kind of ire against, you know, single mothers, single Black mothers, or single mothers of color, in the context of the continental U.S. And probably in other places, what it doesn't understand, excuse me, is that these are mothers making worlds, right? And this is what I found in not only the documentary, which, by the way, After Maria is a documentary that shows, depicts precisely this. Three single mothers, head of household, making a go in the Bronx, in the diaspora, after they lost everything in Hurricane Maria. So it's incredible that it would create this ire among viewers in Puerto Rico. And what made them so upset is that it showed poverty, and it showed people struggling in a system that excludes them. I mean, right? So matriarchal dispossession really talks about, you know, about all of this historical rejection of single-headed households of mothers of color and Black mothers particularly. And so what I try to do is kind of show how productive, right? And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to say that that's the only people who are worth it or worthy, the productive people. But I mean, if you are a mother, if you're a mother of, you know, if you have children, right, there is no, you know, whether you, you know, it doesn't matter what it is you're doing. You're being productive because you're investing in raising kids. I mean, it might not be the kind of productivity, and in fact, it isn't, right? Child rearing is not the kind of productivity that is recognized in the patriarchal capitalist system. Homework, right? The work that we do at home is not recognized as valid, as productive, as interesting, as useful. And yet, we're producing people, the humans who are going to people the society, right? And so I wanted to talk about all of that and kind of show that matriarchal dispossession is this, what is it? It's a kind of middle class or, you know, middle and upper class fallacy or misconstruction or misunderstanding of how matriarchy works within impoverished communities. It is a source of wealth, right? The matriarch is wealthy. The matriarch is important, right? The matriarch has knowledge. The matriarch shares that knowledge. The matriarch, you know, passes intergenerational knowledge in the community to all genders, not only to, it passes specific knowledge to girls, but it also passes other kinds of knowledge to everyone else too, right? So, you know, what is that knowledge, right? Cooking, comportment, behavior, acceptability, responsibility, accountability, right? Creation of, you know, initiatives to better your community, help, solidarity, care, love. I mean, we can go on and on and on, right? And so this is what I wanted to point out with this term matriarchal dispossession, which I feel, you know, if nothing else, is a really important key takeaway in this work.
Speaking of making initiatives to help the community, I think now is a wonderful time to introduce listeners to Idebajo.
Yeah. So Idebajo, Idebajo is the acronym for Iniciativa de Ecodesarrollo de Bahía de Jobos. So what that means is Initiative for the Eco Development of the Jobos Bay. And Idebajo is a umbrella organization under which there are several other smaller organizations. So Idebajo is like the big kind of, if you would say it's not corporate, but if you would, you know, to liken it to something, it's like this big organization under which many different organizations work, including the one with whom I work, two of which I work closely with, which is Diálogo Ambiental, Comité Diálogo Ambiental, which is an environmental committee, and with another organization, which is a neighborhood group called El Coquí, which is the name of a neighborhood in the Jobos Bay. And so Idebajo has an interesting history because they formally came together as Idebajo in 2010. Okay, so that seems recent if you think of Idebajo as the beginning, but it isn't the beginning, right? There have been, the founders of Idebajo are the same people who have been working in this region against environmental injustice and poverty. So I think that's the other connection that I should make clear, that this is also, it's not just about environmental and it's in relation to environmental, but it's also about poverty, right? So many of the folks who've been working with Idebajo since 2010 were people who have been working since really 60s, 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, and early 2000s under different organizations and different initiatives, right? And then in 2010, they decided to really, really, you know, bring it together and be, you know, a lot more cohesive and intentional as they went forward. And some of those folks are, you know, I'll mention a few who are really important to Idebajo is Nelson Santos, who's an incredibly important community organizer and elder in El Coquí and in the Jobos Bay. And Ruth Santiago, who is, of course, really, really a significant environmental activist and community lawyer. There is another man named Victor Alvarado, who was there, you know, since childhood. Some of these people were children, actually, when they first started. Really, it's amazing. Victor Alvarado is, and I are basically the same age, right? So, and he, when I interviewed him, he was telling me how he was, you know, he started organizing and doing activism when he was like 12, you know, living in a housing project in the Jobos Bay in Salinas. So because he was already aware that they were confronting, right? And the same thing with Ruth Santiago. She's in her 60s, but she was in high school when she started thinking about this in before she went to college, before she went to become an environmental lawyer in the, you know, late 70s and 80s. She was already involved in trying to figure out, okay, how can we help our communities rise out of this poverty and to militate against environmental injustice that they were seeing encroaching upon their communities. And then another important person is among many, many, but is Menia Figueroa, and who is the president of the El Coquí Community Board. And another woman is Wanda de Jesus, really important. So there's a number of people who have been working with Idebajo, with what is now in Idebajo for, you know, a very long time under other organizations. But so I touched upon briefly on the history of the Jobos Bay, right? When I tell you that people have been fighting against the encroaching environmental pollution through, you know, because all these pharmaceuticals and oil refineries and energy complexes were placed in their communities. And so basically they live in the shadow of all of these companies. And so they saw the, you know, the harms, the pollution and the contamination really early on. And so they began fighting, you know, quite early on too. But in terms of the Hawa's Bay, just briefly, you know, this is a region that was a sugar producing region, right? And so this is a plantation region. So this is the modern day, the present, right, of what was a plantation in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, and 20th century, actually, right? So this is, you know, it's a kind of study, if you would, in what the scholar Françoise Vergès, who's from Reunion Island, she talks about the racial capitalocene. And I think this region is really a study in the racial capitalocene, right? It's this region in which, you know, Africans were brought to toil in the plantations, and then their descendants, right, did so for, you know, several hundred more years. And then slavery was abolished, but racism was not. So they were left to fend for themselves in an incredibly oppressive and racist system, society, communities. You know, they were, you know, an incredibly racist state, local and federal, incredibly racist education system, right? Incredibly racist labor system. And so they were left to fend for themselves in their black skins, right? In a world which rejected them and made their lives difficult. So what happens in this region is that after the plantations leave, after the plantations become, you know, for-profit plantations, and then those close, and they leave thousands and thousands of workers without jobs in the sugar industry. So there's no more sugar to cut. There's no more sugar to process. This is, you know, it was an agricultural industrial monoculture. It was sugar. That was what moved the wheels here, and sugar left, right? And so, you know, what happened in this region, what happens to those people is that the poverty level, of course, rises as jobs vacate. And then all of these pharmaceuticals and oil refineries and energy producing entities come in, right? But they don't produce jobs for local people, right? And so the local people, I mean, there's a segment of the local people who never depended on those jobs anyway, because they were fishing and they were, you know, foraging. This is the Hobos Bay is Puerto Rico's second most significant estuary. So there's, as an ecosystem, it's a very rich ecosystem, right? There's mangroves, wetlands, and the sea. And so people learn, there's a segment of the population that really learned to make a living from harvesting, right? The mangrove, the sea, and the wetlands, right? So those people have had, I think, a much better experience in this system because they've never depended upon the state or capital to provide for their lives, right? But it was the folks who were dependent upon formal employment who had, you know, much more difficult time surviving in the Hobos Bay, particularly after the sugar industry left. And then they were faced, of course, with the contamination of their ecosystem, which with the contamination of the ecosystem, everyone, right, is affected, right? No matter how you make your living, you know, if your soil, water, air, and, you know, land is contaminated, then This is what Carlos Garcia, Dr. Carlos Garcia, who's an environmental anthropologist and cultural ecologist, this is what he calls when people don't have access to their lands anymore and to the ecosystem. He calls it a catastrophic loss of resilience, right? Because as long as you have a healthy ecosystem, right, you can forage, right, and you can make a living, particularly if that's your skill set. If you're a fisher, if you're a forager, you can surely make a living from harvesting from the ecosystem. So if people lose a healthy ecosystem, then they also experience this catastrophic loss of resilience, which Dr. Garcia Quijano talks about.
You mentioned environmental injustice, and in the book you distinguish between environmentalism and environmental justice. What are the differences between the two?
So I talk about environmentalism as slightly different from environmental justice activists, and actually to the ideology as well behind each of these. So they're not one and the same. And I think anyone familiar with like John Muir, right? And like the Sierra Club will quickly, and especially now that the Sierra Club is reconfiguring itself to be more environmentally justice minded, will know this kind of distinction, right? But essentially the environmentalism has been this kind of ideology of, you know, reparation of ecosystem, but it doesn't include the people who live in the ecosystem. And oftentimes it blames the people of the ecosystem for the destruction of the ecosystem or the over-harvesting of the ecosystem. When in fact, it is often the people who live in an ecosystem who are both its managers and its stewards and more than both, right? More than that. They're also its protectors. So environmentalism tends to make this kind of, you know, tends to be interested in like conservation, right? And endemic species, and often produces or leads with a fortress mentality, right? So they're like, we're going to conserve this piece of land, but nobody can go there. Or if they go there, right, there's all these, you know, a list of rules you have to follow. Like, in Puerto Rico, that's actually a big issue right now. In people, I don't quite think that people realize what's happening in terms of this distinction specifically. They realize what's happening. I just think there is an ideology of environmentalism that is being enacted at this very moment, and people are not always able, you know, if you don't know, you can't connect the dots immediately. But so just quickly, as in Puerto Rico right now, there is this issue in which there's coastal gentrification. So all of these wealthy, many of them, you know, Americans, Euro-Americans, are buying up coastal lands in Puerto Rico and quickly gentrifying, which means that they're making it exceedingly difficult for people who live there to remain there, A, and B, they have driven up the prices to like these staggering amounts of money, right? Like most Puerto Ricans are not able to plunk down $18 million for a house at the beach, right? And this is what they're doing. They're driving up these prices into these ridiculous amounts so that basically they are assured that only wealthy people like them can live there in those places, right? But coastal communities in Puerto Rico have, such as the Jobos Bay, have historically been the communities of the poor, actually, of impoverished communities. So it's kind of, you know, this curse of a beautiful, right, the curse of the resource curse, in this case, the curse of beauty, now that people want, right, now that people want leisure all the time, or they want to work remotely from the beach, right? And so how this relates to this distinction between environmentalism and environmental justice is that there is, this has happened in a few communities, but there is this community in, actually, it was a wealthy Puerto Rican enclave to begin with, but it's called Ocean Park. And this is in the north, this is in the San Juan region. But recently, there was a couple, he's American, and I believe the woman was Puerto Rican, but they bought a house right on the beach at Ocean Park. And on a Saturday, I don't know, on a weekend day, local youth came to the beach to play volleyball at the beach. So they were setting up their nets. And the lady whose house is right at the beach, right? But the beach is a public beach. She has no rights over the public beach, but her house faces this public beach. She came out of her house to say that they had to leave. They couldn't play there because they were disturbing her peace, right? And then in that video, one of the youth videoed her harassing them to leave. And the young person said, this is a public beach. And the lady said, well, it will be... She said, you don't have access to this unless you have millions. Unless you pay millions, right? As is asserting, her claim is, I paid millions for this, so I have rights, and you don't because you didn't pay millions for this, right? So anyway, how this relates to environmentalism, and I actually have another anecdote, but it relates to environmentalism because in the U.S., and these people actually are transplants from the mainland to Puerto Rico. In the U.S., the way that people use beaches is in this kind of environmentalism way, which is you go to the beach and you're very quiet and you're there to enjoy the beauty, to hear the birds, to hear the grass rustling against the wind, to hear the waves. And you could go to a beach. I live in Rhode Island where there's 300 miles of beaches. It's packed. You see people and dogs and children all around you, but you don't hear anything. You don't hear them. There's no, it's not loud. You don't hear them. Whereas in Puerto Rico, the culture is one in which sound is really important, in which communication and joy and like expressing your joy verbally and through song is really important, right? So these folks, these environmentalists, right? And this woman, I mean, I'm not sure that she was an environmentalist, but I wouldn't be surprised, the lady who was harassing the young people, thinks she has a right to nature without the people and without the culture of that place. And because she paid money, it has to be what she says it is, which is a quiet beachfront that she can just look out at the ocean all day long without any kind of disturbance, right? So environmentalists tend to have this kind of mentality where there's a lot of, I mean, it's not, I don't want to stereotype, and so I want to just be fair, but there is this way in which environmentalists of this kind of classic ilk, in particularly North American, I should also say that in the John Muir vein of environmentalist, are not interested in culture, right? They're interested in nature in this kind of quote unquote pristine way, right? And this is problematic because, you cannot really separate any ecosystem from the culture or the people, which is part of it, right? And environmentalists also in the case of Puerto Rico have tended to be, upper class, university educated. They love nature. They don't really quite know or understand people. They don't always understand people's relationship to place in the cultural sense, right? So, in relation to plants and bodies of water and the relationship, between people and animals, right? And in non-human animals, I should say, and how those two really are symbiotic, And so that's a problem. Whereas environmental justice tends to be an ideology or a way of thinking about ecosystem that includes people, that is often people led, right? And by people, I mean community people. So environmental justice is often a doctrine that emerges from the community itself, right? Trying to achieve justice in their communities. And so this is a very different lens from which to act, I guess I would say. I'll tell you this anecdote too, and I should have written it in the book, but when I was doing field work, I was at a, this was in like 20, was it? I don't know if it was before, maybe 2018. I was at a meeting in one of the communities in the Hobos Bay. And the meeting was about the coal, toxic coal ash. And it was about thinking about strategies, right, to convey to the public as to why this toxic coal ash, right, is detrimental to the ecosystem, right? So this is the kinds of meetings communities have. They get together. These are people, you know, grandmothers, grandfathers, you know, some have college, some didn't finish high school, right? These are the kinds of meetings. People sit in a circle, right? And everybody gets a chance to say what they're thinking and other people listen. No, there's no podium. There's no, you know, hierarchies in that kind of way. Of course, the elders are respected and people give them more space and time to think and talk. And people listen to the elders too, quite a bit. But there is no kind of knowledge hierarchy. That's what I want to say. Like in a university meeting. And I went to this meeting and we're sitting in a circle and the facilitator was a man who was not from the community. He lived in, you know, another part of the island altogether. But he, for some reason, and actually was kind of a mystery still to some folks in the community, he was kind of leading and facilitating the meeting. And so I had met him before at another strategizing meeting and at that meeting there were like, you know, 20 communities from all over the island. So that's when I first met this man, and he was an environmentalist. He was a Euro Puerto Rican man, university educated. I think he had an engineering degree and a law degree. Very well spoken, very well presenting, and very assured of his stance and his beliefs and his ideas about environment. And he came to this community meeting in the Hobos Bay to facilitate this meeting about health and toxic coal ash and passing the message out to the public how this is detrimental. So we have met before, and then he saw me. I was there as an observant. I was just there, you know, witnessing and being there in as an ethnographer, I suppose. And we have met before, and he said, you know, at the other meeting, at that kind of bigger meeting, and he said, you know, I was introduced to him, and then he says, oh, you're an anthropologist, yeah. And then he said, oh, you know, I'd like to see some of your work, and I heard you've written some stuff, so if you can send it to me, sure. So I sent him through email some of my publications, which were all about environmental justice and environmental racism. And so the next time I see him at this community meeting, he was really angry at me, visibly angry, because he, and then, so in the middle of the meeting, he puts me on the spot and says, perhaps, you know, Hilda here can explain how racism has anything to do with environmental problems. There is no racism in Puerto Rico. This isn't about environmental racism. And he's a white man sitting with 20 Afro-descendant people. So we're all looking at each other like, he's gone mad. And he says, I do agree with her that there is a class issue. So that poverty is the reason why, or, you know, the reason this is happening in this community, because this is a poor community with no political power or representation, which is, of course, one of the reasons environmental injustice happens in some communities. But he outright denied, even though he was sitting circled by Afro descent, visibly Black people, he said, there is no racism in Puerto Rico. And he said this with a straight face, no questions, no ifs, no buts. He was certain. And he wanted to put me in the spot with the community so that the community would back him. Yes, we feel no racism here. A community that is the descendants of enslaved people, right? So this is this is an example of how environmentalists with good intentions, because of course he was sitting there, he was participating and trying to help, right? So his intentions are good, right? But without any, right, awareness of the, you know, larger issues around race and class and gender that plague environmental injustice frontline communities, right? And this is a problem. And this is the distinction between environmentalists and environmental justice activists, that environmental justice activists take into account, you know, ecosystem relations, gender, class, race, poverty, you know, like all of the kind of isms that plague them, because they live and breathe the air, they drink the water, they plant in the land, they deal with the non-human animals, right? And steward that spot. So this is, you know, this is the distinction that I want to make, or that I do make in the book. Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're reaching the end of our time together, yeah. But I'm sure as listeners can catch from this interview, this book is packed full with wonderful information. You touch on everything from different activist initiatives to anthropological methodology, as we talked about, to theorizations of resilience, as you mentioned. You talk about the history of Puerto Rico. People can learn about the history of Puerto Rico in this book. It's packed full, despite not being a very long book. Mm-hmm. I have one final question, which is a tradition on the New Books Network, which is, what are you working on now?
That's a good question. It's a one that I'm usually super guarded about. I'm one of these people who just, you know, it's over here in a cave hiding from everyone and everything, so I can think. but my, I'm working on a book that touches on, or that deals directly or completely with what I'm calling Afro-coastal lives. And I'm working on that book. It will be a co-author book with Dr. Garcia Quijano, Carlos Garcia Quijano, whose work has really centered on the ecology of coastal regions in Puerto Rico. And so we're working together on the book that will deal with livelihoods and everyday lives of Afro-coastal people. So we'll focus quite a bit on everyday livelihoods and on things like foraging and fishing and the use of, you know, the ecosystem for survival, that I think is kind of the other, you know, the other part, the other coin that needs to be explored when you think about, you know, Afro-descendant coastal communities. Yeah, in the Americas. Mm-hmm.
The book is Making Livable Worlds, published with the University of Washington Press in 2021. Professor Hilda Jorenz, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.